A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's pointing to the standoff between the EU and Iran, and President Trump's claim that Iran's highly enriched uranium is contained, and therefore not a threat. Israel and plenty of others aren't buying that assurance. The question is, what actual precedent exists for seizing highly enriched uranium from a state, voluntarily or otherwise? Because it sounds like something that almost never happens, except it has. Venezuela, most recently. He's asking what other cases there are, and what protocols exist for handling and storing the stuff wherever it ends up. So where do we even start with this?
We start with what contained actually means, because that word is doing a lot of work. The III's most recent quarterly report, from May of this year, puts Iran's stockpile of uranium enriched to 60% at roughly 275 kilograms. That's up from 142 kilograms in March. So in 2 months, they've nearly doubled it. Contained is not the word I'd reach for.
Contained. Sounds like you put a lid on a jar.
And the jar is still on the stove, and someone keeps turning up the burner. 60% enrichment is not weapons grade, that's 90%. But the jump from 60 to 90 is technically trivial. It's the last sprint. The hard part is getting from natural uranium, which is 0.7% U-235, up to the 3-5% you need for a power reactor. Iran already did that. Then they did the harder part, which is getting to 20%, then 60. At 60%, you're maybe 2 weeks from a weapon's worth of 90% material. That's why Israel's not sleeping well.
Contained is a political claim, not a technical one.
In nuclear security, containment and security are two different things. Containment is a verification concept. It means the material is accounted for, that SEALs and cameras and inspectors can confirm it hasn't moved. Security is physical protection, armed guards, hardened storage, defense in depth. Iran has restricted IIEI inspector access since 2021. The cameras at some enrichment sites were disconnected. So we don't have full containment, and we certainly don't have security by any international standard. What we have is a declaration from Tehran that the material is where they say it is.
The question of the prompt is, has anyone ever just gone in and taken it?
Let's start with the most recent precedent, because it's the one most people haven't heard about. Venezuela, 2023 to 2024.
Venezuela had highly enriched uranium.
They had a research reactor, the RV-1, at the Venezuelan Institute for Scientific Research, the IVIC facility near Caracas. It was a small pool-type reactor, Soviet-designed, originally supplied in the 1960s. It ran on HEU fuel. By the early 2000s, the EU had been pushing to repatriate HEU for research reactors worldwide under the Global Threat Reduction Initiative. Venezuela was on the list. But under Chavez and then Maduro, cooperation stalled. By 2023, the reactor had been shut down for years, but the fuel was still there, about 13 kilograms of HEU in the form of MTR fuel elements, which are these flat plates of uranium-aluminum alloy sandwiched in aluminum cladding.
For context, how much do you need for a weapon?
A crude gun-type device might need 50 to 60 kilograms of HEU. A more sophisticated implosion design could get it done with 15 to 20. So Venezuela's 13 kilos wasn't quite a weapon's worth, but it wasn't far off. And more importantly, it was sitting in a country with a collapsed economy, widespread corruption, and documented ties to groups that would love to get their hands on fissile material.
How did it get removed?
This is where it gets interesting. In late 2023, the Maduro government, under significant international pressure and in the context of broader negotiations with the EU, agreed to allow the IIII to oversee the repatriation of the HEU to Russia, which was the original supplier. The operation took months of planning. You can't just put HEU in a suitcase. The MTR fuel elements had to be loaded into specialized transport casks. These are massive steel containers with lead shielding and impact, absorbing structures designed to survive a plane crash or a direct hit from a rocket-propelled grenade. The casks were flown out on a Russian Antonov An-12-4 cargo plane with UNI IEI technical teams on the ground.
Venezuela agreed to it. That's a voluntary handover, not a seizure.
It's a gray area. Maduro agreed under duress. Sanctions relief was on the table, and the implicit alternative was that someone else might come take it. But yes, it was technically voluntary. Which makes it very different from what we'd be looking at with Iran. Iran is not agreeing to anything.
Let's go back further. You mentioned Operation Sapphire.
Operation Sapphire, 1994. This is the big one. After the Soviet Union collapsed, Kazakhstan found itself with a staggering inheritance, more than 600 kilograms of HEU, sitting at the Ulba Metallurgical Plant in Ust-Kamenogorsk. This was weapons-grade material, 90% enriched, enough for roughly 24 nuclear weapons. And it was stored in a warehouse protected by, and I'm not exaggerating, a padlock and a single guard who wasn't always there.
The security protocol of a self-storage unit.
The Kazakh government knew they couldn't secure it. They didn't have the money, the expertise, or the infrastructure, so they reached out to the United States through diplomatic back channels. The Clinton administration moved fast. The operation was classified until after it was completed. In November 1994, a team from the U Department of Energy and the Defense Department flew to Kazakhstan. They spent weeks repackaging the HEU. It was in various forms, including oxide powder and metal ingots, into roughly 1,000 specially designed containers.
1,000 containers.
For 600 kilos. Think about the logistics. Each container had to be sealed, monitored for radiation leakage, and loaded onto C-5 Galaxy cargo planes. The C-5 is one of the largest aircraft in the world, and it took multiple flights. The material was flown to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, then trucked under heavy security to the Y-12 National Security Complex in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where it was eventually downblended into low-enriched uranium for commercial reactor fuel.
That's a 600-kilogram operation. Iran has, what, 275 kilos of 60% material, plus a larger stockpile of lower enrichment uranium. The scale is bigger, but the enrichment is lower. How do those compare logistically?
They don't scale linearly. 600 kilos of 90% HEU is a much denser problem, literally, in terms of criticality safety. The more enriched the material, the more careful you have to be about how much you put in one place because it can go critical, start a self-sustaining chain reaction, if you're not careful about geometry and spacing. Iran's 60% material is less of a criticality risk per unit mass, but there's more total mass, and it's distributed across multiple sites.
Distributed across multiple sites? That's a phrase that should make everyone nervous.
Natanz is the big one. That's the main enrichment facility, with thousands of centrifuges in underground halls. Fordow is smaller but harder to reach. It's buried under a mountain built into a former revolutionary guard base. And there may be undeclared sites. The IIEI has been asking about traces of enriched uranium found at locations Iran hasn't declared. So you're not just planning one extraction, you're planning potentially three or more, some of which are hardened against airstrikes.
One of the misconceptions the prompt hints at is that seizing HEU is like grabbing cash from a vault. You just take it and go.
That's the Hollywood version. The reality is that HEUW, especially in the form of uranium hexafluoride gas, which is what Iran stores from its centrifuges, is chemically aggressive, radiologically hazardous, and requires constant temperature control. UF6 turns into a solid at around 64 degrees Celsius, and it reacts violently with moisture in the air to produce hydrofluoric acid, which dissolves glass and bone. You don't just toss it in the back of a truck. You need specialized cylinders, usually made of nickel alloy or monel, that can withstand the pressure and corrosion. Each cylinder holds maybe 10 to 15 kilograms of uranium. So for 275 kilograms, you're looking at 20 or more of these cylinders, each weighing hundreds of pounds.
You have to move them across international borders.
Which brings us to the third case from the prompt's question, the 2008 Georgia Sting. This one is smaller in scale but instructive in a different way. In 2008, Georgian authorities, working with the U Nuclear Smuggling Initiative, ran a sting operation that recovered about 100 grams of HEU from a smuggling ring trying to sell it on the black market.
100 grams is nothing compared to hundreds of kilograms.
It's nothing in terms of bomb making. You'd need hundreds of times that. but it's everything in terms of demonstrating how HEU moves through illicit networks. The sellers were Armenians who claimed they had access to much larger quantities stored in Russia. They brought a sample to Tbilisi, and the sting caught them. The point is that small quantities are terrifyingly hard to track. 100 grams of HEU fits in a cigarette pack. It doesn't set off radiation portal monitors if it's shielded with lead, which is exactly what the smugglers did. Now scale that problem up. If a state like Iran wanted to move small quantities covertly to proxy groups or undeclared sites, detecting it would be extraordinarily difficult.
The smuggling risk is a parallel concern to the seizure question. Even if you secure the main stockpile, you might never account for everything.
That's the nightmare scenario for non-proliferation people. The known stockpile is the problem you can plan for. It's the unknown that keeps people up at night.
Let's talk about what happens after. Assume you've seized the material, somehow, from wherever. What do you do with it?
This is where the IIEI's guidelines come in. The key document is INF-CRC 225 Revision 5, which is the Nuclear Security Recommendations document. It defines Category 1 material. That's the highest classification. As HEU in quantities greater than 5 kilograms, or plutonium in quantities greater than 2 kilograms. Category 1 material requires, quote, the highest level of physical protection. That means 24/7 armed guards, tamper-indicating seals, dual containment barriers, access control with at least 2 independent layers, and continuous radiation monitoring.
Dual containment. What does that actually mean?
It means you have the primary container, the cylinder or cask holding the material, and then a secondary barrier around it, like a vault or a secure room with separate access controls. The idea is that breaching one layer doesn't get you to the material. It's the nuclear equivalent of a bank vault inside a bank vault. At Y-12, where a lot of UHEU is stored, they have something called the Highly Enriched Uranium Materials Facility. It's a concrete and steel fortress that cost over $500 million to build. The walls are designed to withstand a fully loaded passenger jet. That's the standard for Category 1.
Iran's material is sitting in... what?
The Tons has hardened underground halls, but they're designed to survive airstrikes, not to meet IIIEI security standards. Fordo is under a mountain, which is great for physical protection against bombs, but the access controls and material accounting systems? We don't know. The IIEI doesn't have full access. So, you have a situation where the material is physically hard to reach, but not necessarily well accounted for once you're inside.
There's another option you mentioned in your notes. Downblending. What is that, and why does it matter?
Downblending is the process of converting HEU into LEU, low-enriched uranium, which can't be used for weapons. You take the HEU, which might be 90% U-235, and mix it with either natural uranium or depleted uranium, which has very little U-235, to bring the enrichment down to the 3-5% range used in commercial power reactors. Once it's downblended, it's irreversible. You can't re-enrich it without putting it back through centrifuges, which would take years and a massive industrial effort that's hard to hide.
Downblending is the permanent solution. You're not just locking it up, you're destroying its weapons potential.
And we've done this before. Operation Sapphire's 600 kilos eventually became fuel for commercial reactors. Downblended something like 140 metric tons of HEU from its own weapons program after the Cold War, under the megatons to megawatts program with Russia. The 2013 removal of Syria's declared HEU stockpile, that was a small amount, but it was downblended under OPCW supervision. Ghana voluntarily repatriated its HEU to China in 2016. These are the models.
None of those involved a hostile state refusing to cooperate.
Every precedent we have involves either a collapsed state, Kazakhstan after the Soviet Union, or a cooperative government, even if the cooperation was grudging, like Venezuela. Iran is neither collapsed nor cooperative. That's what makes the current standoff unprecedented. You're looking at a functioning state with a significant military, deep underground facilities, and a declared policy of resisting international pressure on its nuclear program. Seizing HEU from Iran would require either a military operation, which would be vastly more complex than the 1981 Osirak strike or the 2007 Syrian reactor strike, because you're not just destroying a facility, you're extracting material, or a negotiated handover, which would require a diplomatic breakthrough that looks unlikely right now.
Let's talk about the military option, because that's the one people speculate about. What would it actually take?
You'd need to secure the site first, which means neutralizing air defenses, ground forces, and any quick reaction units nearby. Natanz is in Isfahan province, not exactly a remote desert. Fordow is near Qom, which is a religious center and heavily populated. Then you'd need to bring in teams to locate and package the material. That's hours, if not days of work, under hostile conditions. Then you'd need a secure air corridor to fly the material out, which means air superiority over central Iran for the duration of the operation. And all of this assumes you know where all the material is, which we've already established is uncertain.
The military option is a non-starter for anything short of a full-scale conflict.
I wouldn't say non-starter. Israel has demonstrated repeatedly that it's willing to take extraordinary risks to deny nuclear capabilities to hostile states. But the complexity is orders of magnitude greater than anything they've attempted. The 2007 Syrian reactor strike was a single building in the desert. Oserak in 1981 was a single reactor under construction. This would be multiple sites, some underground, with material that has to be secured and removed, not just destroyed.
Destroying it in place creates its own problems. You're not eliminating the material, you're dispersing it.
That's the dirty bomb scenario. If you bomb an enrichment facility, you're not vaporizing the uranium, you're pulverizing it and spreading it over a wide area. That's a radiological disaster. It's not a nuclear explosion, but it's an environmental and public health catastrophe. So even the military option that's simpler, just bomb it, has catastrophic knock-on effect.
Let's circle back to the protocols. The prompt asks specifically about safe handling and storage. What are the steps from the moment someone takes physical custody of HEU?
Step 1 is characterization. You need to know exactly what you have. The chemical form, the enrichment level, the isotopic composition, the mass. Is it UF6 gas in cylinders? Is it oxide powder? Is it metal? Is it fuel elements like Venezuela? Each form requires different handling. UF6 needs temperature control and corrosion-resistant containers. Oxide powder is easier to handle but presents an inhalation hazard. Metal is the most stable but also the most attractive for diversion because it's closest to weapons, usable form. Packaging and transport. The IIEI has detailed regulations for this, the SSR-6, which is the Transport Safety Regulations. For Category 1 material, you need Type B packages, which are designed to withstand a sequence of accident conditions, a 9-meter drop onto an unyielding surface, a 1-meter drop onto a steel punch, a 30-minute fire at 800 degrees Celsius, and immersion in water. These packages weigh tons. They're not man-portable. Then you need secure transport, armed escort, real-time tracking, pre-cleared overflight rights, and contingency plans for every leg of the journey.
Overflight rights. That's a diplomatic nightmare in the Middle East.
Imagine trying to fly a cargo plane loaded with Iranian HEU through Turkish, Iraqi, or Saudi airspace. Every country along the route needs to be notified, and many of them would refuse. The diplomatic preparation alone could take months, and it would almost certainly leak, which means you'd have protesters, legal challenges, and possibly hostile action at every stop.
Step 3. You've arrived at wherever you're taking it.
Step 3 is storage. You need a facility that meets those INF-CIRC 225 standards we talked about. If you're the United States, you've got Y-12 and Savannah River. If you're Russia, you've got Mayak and other close cities. But most countries don't have Category 1 storage facilities. So if the material is being removed to a third country, say for downblending in a neutral location, that country needs to build or upgrade a facility first. That's a multi-year, multi-hundred-million-dollar project.
Step 4 is the downblending itself.
Downblending sounds simple. You're just mixing two things. But it's a precision industrial process. You need to calculate the exact ratios to hit your target enrichment. You need to do it in a way that doesn't create criticality risks during the mixing process. For UF6, you're blending gases. For oxide, you're blending powders. Either way, you need specialized equipment in a licensed facility. Does this routinely at the Y-12 and Savannah River sites, but is not something you can set up in a tent.
The full chain is locate, characterize, package, transport, store, downblend. Each step has its own technical, diplomatic, and security challenges. And Iran's case makes every single step harder.
That's the core insight. The precedents we have. Kazakhstan, Venezuela, Georgia, Ghana, Syria. each involved one or two of these steps being relatively straightforward because the host government was cooperative or absent. Iran's situation makes every step contested. You're not just solving a logistics problem, you're solving it while someone is actively trying to stop you.
Let's talk about the legal framework, because that's another layer. Under what authority can a foreign power seize HEU from a sovereign state?
This is where it gets legally murky. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, gives the IAEA the authority to verify that non-nuclear weapon states are not diverting nuclear material to weapons, but the NPT doesn't authorize seizure. The IAEA can refer a non-compliance finding to the UN Security Council, which can impose sanctions or authorize action under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. That's the legal path. The JCPOA, the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, had a snapback mechanism that would automatically reimpose UN sanctions if Iran violated the deal. But the EU withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018, and the snapback mechanism is in a legal gray area now.
There's no clear, you may now seize the uranium clause in international law.
There isn't. Any seizure would be justified under broader claims. Self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, or authorization by the Security Council, or, in the case of a non-cooperative state, a claim that the material poses an imminent threat. But these are political and legal arguments, not settled doctrine. Every seizure in history has either been voluntary or occurred in the context of a state that had effectively ceased to function, like the Soviet successor states.
The Venezuela case is instructive here. Maduro agreed, but he extracted concessions. The HEU became a bargaining chip.
That's exactly what's happening with Iran. Trump's claim that the material is contained is part of a negotiation. The implicit message is, we're not going to take it by force, so let's make a deal. Iran's countermove is to keep enriching, keep expanding the stockpile, and raise the stakes. The HEU is leverage. The question the prompt is really asking is, what happens if the leverage game fails? What's the backup plan?
The backup plan, as we've seen, ranges from extraordinarily difficult to effectively impossible, depending on how cooperative Iran is.
Let me add one more precedent that's relevant, even though it's not HEU seizure. In 2013 to 2014, Syria agreed to dismantle its declared chemical weapons stockpile under OPCW supervision in the aftermath of the Ghouta sarin attack. That was a negotiated removal of weapons of mass destruction from a country in the middle of a civil war. The logistics were staggering. The material had to be transported from multiple sites to the port of Latakia, loaded onto ships from Denmark and Norway, and then destroyed on a U vessel, the Cape Ray, in international waters. It worked, but it required Syrian cooperation, and even then, we later discovered that Syria had retained undeclared stocks.
Which is exactly the fear with Iran. You negotiate a removal, you celebrate a diplomatic victory, and 5 years later you find out they kept 20 kilos at a site you never knew about.
20 kilos of 60% HEU is a problem. Not a bomb, but a significant head start. That's the thing about HEU. It doesn't spoil. It doesn't degrade. The half-life of U-235 is 700 million years. Once it's enriched, it stays enriched. You can bury it, hide it, forget about it for decades, and when you dig it up, it's just as weapons, usable as the day you made it.
That's a sobering thought to leave people with. A mistake in handling HEU isn't like a mistake with conventional weapons. It doesn't expire.
Which is why the protocols are so demanding, and why the Iran standoff is so consequential. The decisions made in the next year or two about what happens to that material will shape the non-proliferation landscape for decades.
To wrap up the core of the prompt, the precedents are Venezuela, Kazakhstan, Georgia, and a handful of smaller voluntary repatriations. The protocols are characterization, packaging, transport, storage, and downblending, governed by the IAEA's INFCRC-25. And the Iran situation is harder than any precedent, because the state is hostile, the material is distributed, and the diplomatic pathway is uncertain.
Contained remains a word that should make everyone nervous.
Here's what I keep coming back to. The Venezuela case worked because Maduro was isolated and needed sanctions relief. The Kazakhstan case worked because the Soviet Union had collapsed, and the new government was terrified of what was sitting in that warehouse. Iran is not isolated in the same way. It has relationships with Russia and China, and it's not collapsing. So the conditions that made previous HEU removals possible simply don't apply. That means we're either looking at a new kind of negotiated solution, something we haven't seen before, or a military option that nobody wants to contemplate seriously.
The clock is ticking. At current enrichment rates, Iran is adding roughly 60 to 70 kilograms of 60% material per month. By the end of this year, they could have over 500 kilograms. That's enough, if further enriched to 90%, for maybe 10 to 12 weapons. The window for a diplomatic solution that involves removing the material is closing.
The prompt asks what listeners can do. What should they watch for?
Watch the IIEI's quarterly reports. The next one will be in August. Look for three things: the total stockpile of 60% material, any mention of enrichment to 90%, and any changes in inspector access. Those three numbers tell you more about the real state of play than any political statement. Also watch the UN Security Council for any movement on snapback sanctions. The JCPOA's snapback mechanism expires in October of this year, which is a hard deadline that's not getting enough attention.
That's 4 months from now. After that, the legal framework for reimposing UN sanctions becomes much harder to invoke.
Iran knows that. They're running out the clock.
The open question is, will the next 12 months produce a negotiated removal, a Venezuela-style operation, but on a much larger scale and under much more adversarial conditions? Or will it force a military confrontation that rewrites the rules of non-proliferation? Because if someone does attempt a non-consensual seizure of HEU from a functioning state, that's a new chapter in nuclear history. There's no playbook for it.
If nobody attempts it and Iran crosses the threshold, that's also a new chapter, one where containment failed, and the world has to figure out how to live with a nuclear-armed Iran. Neither path is good. The question is, which one is less catastrophic?
That's the tension at the heart of this whole standoff. And it's why the word contained is doing more work than any four syllables should have to.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the year 106, astronomers across the Middle East and East Asia recorded a brilliant guest star in the constellation Lupus, the brightest supernova in recorded human history. For centuries, scholars attributed the first observation to the Egyptian astronomer Ali ibn Ridwan. But in 2016, researchers discovered that monks at the Benedictine Abbey of St. Gall in Switzerland had recorded the same event several days earlier. They just hadn't told anyone because they thought it was an omen best kept quiet.
Monks sitting on a supernova.
The original embargoed press release.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes like this one, head to My Weird Prompts. We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.